Matters of Perspective is a subset of the Mormon Matters podcast that presents audio versions of important articles and essays discussed in Mormon Matters episodes or suggested by listeners as being helpful to them in their spiritual journey. If you have a classic LDS writing to suggest that we pursue for the Matters of Perspective series, please write to host Dan Weatherspoon at mormonmatters@gmail.com.
God is calling, calling thee from lands of woe. Babylon the great is falling, God shall the towers o'erthrow. Come to Zion, ere his floods of anger flow. On the Zion, ere his floods of anger flow.
God Wrestling, Physicality, Conflict, and Redemption in Mormon Doctrine by Rick Jepson. First published in Sunstone Magazine, November 2005. I am a wrestler of great enthusiasm and moderate ability. In traveling to tournaments and making acquaintances from all over the world, I've frequently been asked tongue-in-cheek what it is about Mormonism that produces such great wrestlers. The two standout wrestlers in recent Olympics, Cale Sanderson and Rulon Gardner, are both LDS. So is Larry Owings, who beat Dan Gable 32 years earlier in what many regard as the best college wrestling match of all time. Some say that the second best was when Mark Schultz, another Mormon, beat Ed Bannock in 1982. At a seminar I once attended, Schultz joked that if someone wants to be a great wrestler, he should join the church. A year ago, I began looking to see if there might be something connecting these athletes with the first renowned Mormon wrestler, Joseph Smith, and perhaps even to the obscure Old Testament story of Jacob wrestling all night with an angel. Because I wasn't aware of the treasures hidden in the Genesis account, I wasn't looking for anything particularly profound. My original focus in examining Jacob's match was just on period wrestling styles. But that quickly changed as I came to better understand the key role his legendary wrestle played in transforming him from rascal to prophet. Some have even speculated that the way he proved himself in the match, both to himself and God, led to his having his calling and election made sure. Afterward, he limped away as Israel, the God wrestler, father to a chosen nation. Rabbis, theologians, and scholars have all identified with Jacob's struggle and tried to emulate it in dealing with their own trials. A legendary struggle. Jacob's story is familiar. After twice deceiving his brother, Jacob had fled for his life and taken refuge with his uncle. Two wives, two concubines, 12 sons, one daughter, and 20 years of servitude later, he was returning home. But word came that Esau was riding out to meet him with an army of 400. Fearing his brother's revenge, Jacob remained behind but sent his family across the river Jabbok, bearing gifts. Then a stranger appeared who wrestled Jacob through the night. Although his hip was dislocated during the bout, the soon-to-be prophet finally won and refused to release his opponent until he identified himself and gave a blessing. And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaketh." And he said, "I will not let thee go, except thou bless me." And he said unto him, "What is thy name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed." And Jacob asked him and said, "Tell me, I pray thee, thy name." And he said, "Wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name?" And he blessed him there, and Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, "For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." And as he passed over Penuel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. Many biblical commentaries disregard Jacob's story, assuming it's either a fabrication or an adaptation from an earlier myth. The Genesis narrative is not unique in ancient literature, in which wrestling legends abound. The oldest known human wrestling includes the Sumerian saga of Gilgamesh, who changed from tyrant to hero after an epic wrestling match against the demigod Enkidu. Both Hercules and Samson out-wrestled lions, which Brazilian grapplers commemorate with a devastating choke called Mata Leão, or Lion Killer. And Hercules went on to throw and pin several magical opponents. Early Christian writers described Job as a wrestler who threw his opponent in every wrestling bout. Muhammad bested a disbeliever to prove his prophetic status. Even J.R.R. Tolkien's modern creation myth, the Silmarillion, which some call an Old Testament to the Lord of the Rings, has a god who delights in wrestling and in contests of strength. This ubiquity of ancient wrestling myths makes Jacob's struggle hard to take at face value, but the story's fairy tale qualities are even more problematic. His opponent's plea for release before sunrise seems more appropriate for a haunting vampire than a wrestling angel. To some critics, his refusal to divulge his name sounds like a Rumpelstiltskin-type tale. The location suggests to others the echo of a Canaanite river god story. Even among those who accept the scriptural veracity of the meeting, the match is most often interpreted allegorically. Whether or not the Jacob story is accurate history, I believe we have to read it as such to grasp its depth. We must visualize Jacob grappling all night, much of it with a busted hip, or we'll miss the meaning. The author wants us to read it literally, and with good reason. Wrestling is hard. You can hardly breathe, your muscles burn, and you ache to give up. It takes soul to stay in the match, an internal drive not to quit. It's enough to instigate the kind of change that we see in Jacob. Spiritual physicality. I was a green missionary in Boston when the church celebrated the 150th anniversary of the pioneers entering the Salt Lake Valley. Caught up in the prevailing sentimentality, I was surprised when a ward member downplayed the struggles of the Martin Handcart Company. It's not the physical trials that are hard, she contended. Anyone can cross the plains. What's hard is keeping spiritual commandment. My calling prevented any arguing with her, but I disagreed with her then and still do today. I believe physical events are spiritual. Our doctrine suggests as much. There is no such thing as immaterial matter. All spirit is matter. All of our spiritual experiences have physical components. And if our spiritual experiences are all physical, it follows that the reverse is also true. Our physical lives are intimately connected to our spiritual lives. LDS notions differ from the standard Christian vitalism, where the physical is something different and beneath the spiritual. We Latter-day Saints have largely ignored the uniqueness of spiritual physicality in our theology, but it is still there. It's spelled out, and it's supported by our scriptures, our history, and our daily affairs. It's why we benefit spiritually from physical adherence to the word of wisdom. It's why we go without food once a month. It's why, in preparing to meet God, the brother of Jared carried his 16 stones up the tallest mountain he could find. It's why Martin Handcart survivors never left the gospel, and it's why Brigham Young said that prayer is great, but warm potatoes and pudding are better. The scriptures contain many examples of spiritual physicality, and athletic skill has historically been a qualification for leadership. After the burly prophet Elijah beat Baal's priest in a contest of gods, he dishonored the pagan king by outrunning his chariot. Egyptian pharaohs demonstrated their fitness to rule with a 120-yard dash. Persian princes proved authority by superior equestrianism. In ancient Japan, an emperor left his rule to the better wrestler of his two sons. And in 9th century Byzantium, Basil I rose from humble origins to a place of prestige, largely because of his wrestling prowess. The greatest and most spiritual event in human history was also the most physical. Christ's atonement was a decidedly physical ordeal. It was the physicality of the atonement that disheartened him. If it be possible, let this cup pass from me. For there is no trial like physical pain, and no one could wish for it, not even for the sake of others. In George Orwell's 1984, the imprisoned Winston Smith wonders about pain while he awaits certain torture. His lover has also been arrested and faces the same punishment. If I could save Julia by doubling my own pain, he asks himself, would I do it? He knows the answer should be yes, but a baton blow to his elbow reveals the truth. The elbow! He had slumped to his knees, almost paralyzed. Clasping the stricken elbow with his other hand, everything had exploded into yellow light. Inconceivable. Inconceivable that one blow could cause so much pain. One question at any rate was answered. Never, for any reason on earth, could you wish for an increase of pain. Of pain you could only wish one thing, that it should stop. Nothing in the world was so bad as physical pain. In the face of pain, there are no heroes. No heroes, he thought over and over, as he writhed on the floor, clutching uselessly at his disabled left arm. Physical prophets. Physicality punctuated Joseph Smith's life, and his legendary wrestling mirrors Jacob's. Perhaps the best argument for Latter-day Saints reading the Genesis account literally is that we've had another strapping religious leader in our own time who also developed through physical ordeals. Like Jacob, Joseph was the son of an aggressive mother and a visionary but withdrawn father. Father Smith was as debilitated by poverty as Isaac was by blindness. And like Jacob, Joseph grew up in the shadow of a favored brother, though their relationship was one of mutual admiration and not envy. Joseph revered his oldest brother, Alvin, as uncommonly strong and the handsomest man since Adam. And more than anyone, Alvin believed in Joseph's discovery of the plates and was even divinely called to attend their retrieval. At the bed of his untimely death, Alvin encouraged Joseph to fulfill his prophetic destiny. The prophet commemorated his late brother's legacy with a namesake child. Jacob and Joseph were both powerful men, but I don't think they always felt so. The young Jacob seems terrified of his rough brother. And Joseph must have felt impotent in the years following his leg operation, the first of many physical trials he would face. Treating a bone infection 120 years before the discovery of antibiotics required invasive surgery 30 years before the availability of anesthetics. So without providing any relief from pain, the surgeon bored 3 holes by hand through the bone and chipped off the exposed tissue with forceps. For years afterward, Joseph was either in bed, carried by a family member, or up and around only on crutches. He limped and was defenseless against bullying. He must have felt feeble compared to his hardy brothers. How surprising to both men to grow into manhood and discover such physical strength. Joseph's athleticism has become almost folkloric, exaggerated by followers and disputed by critics. He was tall and robust for his time, 6 feet in height and weighing more than 200 pounds, with a tapering torso and a musculature unhidden by clothes. He out-wrestled nearly all comers, even as a weakened prisoner after enduring months at Liberty Jail, he lifted and threw a challenging guard. He could beat stick-pulling champions using just one hand and could out-pull 2 opponents at once. When he retrieved the plates, he was accosted by 3 men, felling each. And when the first mobster rushed up the stairs at Carthage, Joseph sent him rolling back down with 2 quick punches. The man never reascended and later gave the prophet a grudging compliment, calling him a damn stout man. According to the text, Jacob's strength was also remarkable. When he fled Esau's rage and arrived in their mother's homeland, he encountered a group of shepherds stationed around a well. A huge stone was rolled over it to keep the water fresh, and every morning the men gathered until there were enough of them to remove it. When Jacob noticed a beautiful woman approaching, he quickly volunteered to move the stone by himself. If he was trying to show off, it worked. The woman, his cousin Rachel, immediately greeted him. The two kissed and wept. Both Joseph and Jacob had to scuffle before facing God. Jacob wrestled the mysterious stranger and won despite the injury to his hip. Joseph grappled with a darker adversary. When he knelt in the grove, he wasn't overshadowed by some menacing nebula, but attacked by a real demon. He heard its footsteps approaching from behind him, and he described it as an actual being from the unseen world, who had such a marvelous power as I had never before felt in any being. I have wondered if Joseph felt any special connection to Jacob. He was certainly aware of the ancient wrestling prophet. Once in a playful match, Joseph accidentally broke a friend's ankle, and the two of them joked that Joseph should at least have to bless him like the angel had Jacob. Perhaps thinking of Jacob, Joseph used wrestling terminology to describe spiritual events. In the Book of Mormon, Enos writes, "I will tell you of the wrestle which I had before God before I received a remission of my sins." And we read that Alma also labored much in the spirit, wrestling with God in mighty prayer. John A. Tvetnis and Matthew Roper suggest that the Book of Mormon prophets were familiar with Jacob's story and influenced by it. But maybe it was Joseph who identified with Jacob. Whatever the nuts and bolts of translating the Book of Mormon were, the translation was his. His vocabulary and phraseology played a part. Another translator might have written struggle or trial. In either case, Jacob's physical ordeal was profound enough for later prophets to identify with and refer to it in describing their own spiritual struggles. Wrestling for one's life. It's hard to put a face on Jacob's opponent, though many have tried. From the text, we gather that it could have been a man, an angel, or even God. One Jewish legend holds that it was Michael, who had been a guardian angel to Jacob since the womb. Another suggests that it was Esau's guardian angel, Samael. But the match wasn't just between 2 combatants. It was also Jacob's personal struggle to correct an entire life. Some of the best wrestlers struggle with personal demons. Their opponent becomes an embodiment of poverty, divorce, abuse, failure, or whatever haunts them, and they push all the harder because of it. That fixation makes them difficult to defeat because they risk losing more than the match. Any loss is a submission to the monsters that plague them. Dan Gable was undefeated 118-0 through his college career until his very last match to Larry Owings at the NCAA championship. His face didn't show disappointment, it was desolation. For all those years, he had been fighting the man who had broken into his boyhood home, then raped and killed his sister, and now he had finally lost. When Ebenezer Scrooge could no longer stand the memories of Christmases past, he tried to wrestle away the spirit who had brought them, As he turned and clinched, he was shocked to see the messenger's face, in which, in some strange way, there were fragments of all the faces it had shown him that night. Like Jacob, Ebenezer grappled not just with his present foe, but with all the haunting images of a past ill spent. We can only speculate what faces Jacob saw in his adversary, but they likely included his own, his brother's, his father's, his uncle's, and his God's. He genuinely struggled with God and men and persevered. His mother's face may also have been among the many he saw. It is uncommon to wrestle one's mother, but it can happen. My own father, a champion wrestler, endured 20 years of physical abuse before wrestling free of his mother's violence. The liberating impulse came one evening while standing at attention as she whipped him incessantly with an extension cord. He suddenly grabbed both her wrists and held firm until resistance ceased. We call that wrist control in the sport, and it's used to escape dangerous holds. One of the first lessons a young wrestler learns is to control the opponent's wrists before attempting to escape. Grab the wrists and then stand up. Otherwise, you'll be sucked back into his control. On this occasion, wrist control was all it took. She accepted the changed relationship, and he was never abused again. Ironically, his passion for the sport wilted that night, and his distinguished career was cut short. Years later, he reflected that he had really been wrestling her all along. Once he had been victorious, his grappling lacked its fundamental motivation. Rebecca never harmed Jacob, but she smothered her favorite son from the beginning. While Esau romped around the forest, she kept the milder Jacob studying inside the tent. It was she who prodded him to deceive Isaac, and she who shooed him away when it backfired. Nor did he even escape her in exile. He labored 2 decades in her land and among her clan. Jacob had adopted his mother's no-holds-barred approach to fulfilling his destiny. Together they could justify any means, bartering, lying, stealing, because the end was divinely ordained. But the Lord hardly needed their assistance, and their meddling was disastrous. As Jacob sat alone across the river from Esau's army of 400, perhaps he finally wanted to escape the maternal pressure that had caused so much trouble. But Jacob had also become his own worst enemy. He stands out among early Old Testament figures because though he repeats the established patterns of his fathers, he seems more human. Like Abraham and Isaac, he saw visions, married a close relative who struggled with infertility, favored one child over another, and with his wrestling, went through a momentous ordeal, fearing for his life. But unlike his predecessors, Jacob cut corners, bargained, and got distracted. He's been criticized for seeking outside approval, for a lack of initiative, and for his duplicity. This inconsistency and immaturity perplexes the believer. Why would God favor such a person to become the father of all Israel? So it seems necessary to clean up the text. The Jewish traditions go the furthest in redeeming Jacob from his own story. Every misdeed is couched in explanation. Jacob was supposed to be the firstborn, but conceded to save his mother's life. He bought the birthright with money and treasures, not just with lentil soup. And Isaac knew all along that it was Jacob he was blessing. The Midrash tradition is one of contrast, a story of good and evil with characters purposely polarized to represent these twin forces. But today, many Christians and Jews recognize that a deeper understanding comes from recognizing rather than rationalizing Jacob's full person. Jacob is the everyman, and that is what makes his wrestling transformation resonate with us. Like us, he's distracted by everyday affairs. We share his Promethean tendency to want to live as mere humans despite our godly potential. In his story, we realize our own need to be transformed by grappling with ourselves, our past, and before our God. Jacob did just that when the mysterious stranger appeared. And this was no small contest. The thought of grappling all night is staggering. Prime athletes are exhausted after just a 6-minute match. Recent history has seen some similarly epic matches, like Helsing Gracie's 4-hour loss against Valdemar Santana, and Frank Gotch's 2-hour victory over George Hackenschmidt. But these bouts took a huge toll on the competitors. Gracie retired after his loss, and Gotch, though victorious, complained, "It is likely I may never be as good a man again because of that match. Such a contest is a terrible shock to a man's system, no matter how strong or well-trained he may be." Jacob was certainly different after his match. He emerged from the exhausting and injurious night as a new person, changed emotionally and spiritually. After being blessed, seeing God, and receiving his new name, he confidently crossed the river to face Esau in repentant love. He became the father of all Israel, a prophet celebrated throughout our canon. Article sidebar on calling and election. In a 1998 Insight article, Andrew Skinner suggests that Jacob might have received assurance of his calling and election after the all-night wrestling bout. This claim piqued my interest because of my own uncertainty about this doctrine. A deeper investigation clarified for me that while it flies somewhat below the radar, The notion of having one's calling and election made sure is a bona fide LDS doctrine, authenticated throughout our canon and literature. In fact, in the month of my birth, the Ensign published a comprehensive article about calling and election. The author, Roy Doxey, draws extensively from early and contemporary church authorities and develops a simple definition. Although the process of obtaining exaltation continues even into the spirit world, the knowledge that one will become exalted with the privileges of continuing on into eternal life can be certain in this life. This is what making one's calling and election is all about. Jacob's experience after wrestling the stranger seems to fit quite well with the calling and election pattern. He claims to have seen Jehovah face to face and remembers years later the, quote, angel which redeemed me from evil, end quote. Other elements of the encounter are very similar to other sacred ordinances. He is reborn with a new and much better name. Instead of Jacob the supplanter, he becomes Israel, the God wrestler. His wrestling clinch may have signified a ritual embrace, and the angel's injurious touch to Jacob's thigh may have had special commemorative significance. It was an important part of the anatomy in Jacob's world, a place where oaths were formalized. Abraham's servant had put his hand under the patriarch's thigh when making a promise, and Jacob later requests the same of his favored son Joseph. In the Revelation of John, we read that Christ will return with King of Kings and Lord of Lords written on his thigh. While Jacob's overall encounter may differ greatly from contemporary temple ordinances, a similarity in these basic elements is suggestive of an endowing experience. It's important to note that Jacob wasn't perfect after his wrestling match and subsequent blessing. The very next morning, during the tearful reunion with Esau, he lies about where he's going and falsely promises to meet up with his brother again. Having a calling and election made sure does not make someone perfect. Brigham Young reminded the early saints that no blessing that is sealed upon us will do us any good unless we live for it. And more recently, Bruce R. McConkie clarified the recipients of this sealing. Are still imperfect and subject to the repentance process. What is important with Jacob is that a great change was wrought by this ordeal. Though he was still an imperfect mortal, there is an obvious improvement in his character. He is no longer scheming or uncertain. He suddenly has the confidence and power of a prophet. He has become a figure worthy of grouping with his father and grandfather in the oft-repeated phrase, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Resuming the article, making love, making war. There's a certain catharsis that follows any physical exertion. Nerves from the brain and spine release endorphins, little chains of amino acids that function in the body much like a narcotic. The result is just what you would expect from taking an opiate like morphine, a feeling of relaxation and euphoria. In fact, the word endorphin literally means endogenous morphine or morphine from inside the body. Besides that chemical high, any combative sport can give an additional type of exhilaration, that which comes from self-realization and bonding with an opponent. There's something about attacking and being attacked that brings out your personality. You learn a lot about yourself, your fears, your abilities, and your resilience. And your opponent is just as exposed and self-conscious as you are. It's traumatic for both, and that's what makes it a shared bonding experience. Plato, who was an accomplished wrestler, said, "We obtain better knowledge of a person during 1 hour's play and games than by conversing with them for a whole year." And it seems Joseph Smith may have agreed. He was often criticized for his unsanctimonious playfulness, sometimes even by family members or friends. Once Hiram chided him for playing with a group of boys, but Joseph defended himself, saying, "It makes them happy and draws their hearts nearer to mine, and who knows but there may be young men among them who may sometime lay down their lives for me." Boxing, wrestling, ultimate fighting, and usually even street fights are just versions of the ritualized violence found everywhere in the animal kingdom. While there's a winner and a loser, both parties can walk away from the fight. If one stag died every time there was a dispute over territory or mates, there wouldn't be many deer left. So as they charge at each other, they carefully measure their attacking angles. If it looks like they might hit bodies instead of antlers, they quickly pivot out of their trajectories and start over. A few years ago, the novelist Chuck Palahniuk got into his first fistfight. Afterward, he began reflecting on the, quote, redeeming value to taking a punch under controlled circumstances, end quote, and started writing a best-selling novel, Fight Club. When the movie version hit theaters, people identified with its message, the liberating and integrating use of a controlled violence to escape an effectless world. In Utah, a phenomenon began. High school and college students all over the state started sneaking into parks, schools, and even church gyms to strap on boxing gloves and stage amateur fights. The press was negative, particularly when then-Governor Michael Levitt's son got arrested for his participation. But the bouts were controlled. Most groups employed some type of referee, and combatants were normally matched up according to similarity in size and skill. Most bouts were friendly, and most fighters left feeling euphoric, self-aware, and connected. While any combative experience may produce this type of bonding and self-realization, wrestling is particularly suited to do so because a wrestler seeks to subdue an opponent without doing damage. No pure form of wrestling allows for serious striking. And while the domination of an opponent by offsetting, immobilizing, or submitting him is the central aim of any wrestler, the obliteration of that opponent never enters into the equation. A successful wrestler dominates his opponent without crushing him. Even in the aggressive submission styles of wrestling that employ painful chokes and joint hyperextensions, such as judo or jiu-jitsu, most practitioners pride themselves on causing only momentary pain and vigilantly avoid injuring other competitors. Several years ago, the rabbi Arthur Waskow wrote a poem about Jacob's wrestling match, building around a theme that while wrestling feels a lot like making war, it also feels a lot like making love. A strained relationship with his own brother uncovered for Waskow an important aspect of Jacob's story. It tells us how to fight someone we love. We do it while embracing. This intimate aspect of wrestling is important to its symbolism. As one Torah teacher in Jerusalem explained, to wrestle is to embrace. It's a very intimate bodily encounter. Legs around legs and arms around arms, intertwined. There's an erotic element to it. As I face an opponent, one of the strongest positions I can obtain is wrapping both arms around his torso and hugging him in tightly. Then I can dump him, trip him, or throw him, but will remain in that embrace, and regardless of whom or what I may be fighting, I can choose the same approach. I suspect it was the same with Jacob. As he wrestled all the 100 faces that met him, he tried to overcome but not obliterate them. He still loved his brother, his mother, himself, and his God. So he wasn't kicking or eye gouging. I've had that kind of encounter before. In high school, my best friend was 3 years my elder and everything I wasn't. Confident, athletic, popular, and a ladies' man. Our relationship was largely defined by bullying, and I was the perpetual victim. But one day, halfway through my first season of wrestling, our friendship was redefined. For some offense I can't even begin to remember, I found myself running for my life with him on my heels swinging a plastic bat. I was much slower and quickly realized the inevitability of being overtaken. Having no obvious alternatives, I spun around and shot in at his legs. The result surprised us both. There I was on top of him with one hand on his neck and the other cocked back to strike. And the conflict was over. We were ever after equals in our friendship. There had been no kicking, punching, or biting. For then the friendship may have ended. There was just that violent hug that brings down and subdues an opponent. A decade ago, Bill Moyers assembled a diverse group to discuss the book of Genesis. When Jacob's story came up, one panelist shared his own experience wrestling with his father, who had forbidden him to pursue a career in art. He ultimately had to challenge his father physically to be released. It couldn't be done in a reasonable way, he explained. He had to be overcome in a way in which he understood authority. As they wrestled, his father immediately arrived at a state in which he could say, "You are free, and free with my blessing." It wasn't get the hell out of here and never darken this door again. Taking the wrestling posture is also the way to win fights between whole nations. In this kind of struggle, parties operate with mutual decency and a shared regret for the circumstances that led them into the conflict. They fight each other doggedly, but do not hate. I'm reminded of the spontaneous Christmas truces all over the front lines of World War I, and of soldiers at Gettysburg from both armies meeting nightly at a well to drink coffee and share letters. Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, recently gave an interview where he outlined 11 important lessons learned during his tenure. The first was, empathize with your enemy. Comparing the success of the Cuban Missile Crisis with failures in Vietnam, he deemed that the difference was in empathy and understanding. They knew Khrushchev personally and could guess at his motivation. But with the Vietnamese, our government acted with, quote, profound ignorance of the history, culture, and politics of the people in the area and the personalities and habits of their leaders, end quote. Our country is currently engaged in a war with a people and culture very different than our own. There is suspicion, fear, and hatred on both sides, and neither knows much about the other. It's the mutual estrangement that begets atrocities such as 9/11 and Abu Ghraib. But if we can approach this conflict with a wrestling stance, if we can hug while strangling, maybe we can avoid some of the ugliness of war. Sidebar to the article, Jacob and Esau. Even from before birth, wrestling was a part of Jacob's life. He and Esau struggled constantly in the womb, tearing and bruising their mother. In 20 years of marriage, she had been unable to conceive, but now, even though she was finally pregnant, her sorrow continued. She turned to God in her own wrestle. If it be so, why am I thus? The response came. It was her calling to mother two antagonizing peoples. Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. On the day of their delivery, the two boys continued their wrestle. Jacob lashed on to his brother's heel as if to pull him back into the womb, as if to usurp his place as firstborn. Because of this, his father gave him the lowly name Jacob, a wordplay referring both to the anatomical heel and the kind of person we might still call a heel, a supplanter. The two boys grew into manhood, each being the favorite of one parent. Rebecca, remembering the revelation, doted on Jacob, and Isaac, maybe longing for his estranged brother Ishmael, favored the red and hairy Esau. Though Jacob seems to have been a great deal more like his father, we don't always like seeing our reflections. Jacob and Esau had two encounters that were severe enough to be mentioned in the biblical narrative, and both revealed Jacob's wiliness. When his sturdy brother returned famished from a long hunt, Jacob offered him some stew, but only in exchange for the birthright. "Behold, I am at the point to die," Esau sighed. "What profit shall this birthright do unto me?" The text subjectively tells us how little Esau valued that blessing, but the story also shows us to what lengths Jacob would go to wrest his brother's rightful inheritance. A while later, Jacob went on to trick his blind father into giving him a blessing intended for Esau. Isaac had sent the older son out to hunt him some fresh meat and promised a blessing upon his successful return. But Rebekah devised an elaborate deception. She roasted two goat kids and draped their skins over Jacob's neck and arms so the patriarch would think it was Esau. The ruse worked, and Esau returned with venison only to find that his blessing had been given away. "Is not he rightly named Jacob?" Esau complained, "for he hath supplanted me these two times." Esau boiled in rage and sought Jacob's life, so Jacob fled to the refuge of his mother's brother. The exodus was fortunate because it made a man out of the crafty Jacob. On the way there, he had a vision of angels climbing a ladder to heaven. The Lord stood above it and spoke to him, promising that he would someday return to his home and father a numerous progeny. In his mother's homeland, Jacob discovered his strength, fell in love, and became a successful herdsman. But he also learned how it felt to be dealt with underhandedly. His uncle tricked him into marrying Leah instead of Rachel, forced him to double his indentured servitude, and chased him down when Jacob tried to leave. After 20 years, when Jacob had finally broken free and was just across the river from returning home, he had the greatest struggle of his life. Word came that Esau was coming straight toward him with an army of 400 men. Now that Jacob understood the injury he had caused his brother, he could only guess how it had festered over two decades. He repentantly sent his family and flocks ahead of him with this message: "They be thy servant Jacob's. It is a present sent unto my lord Esau." And then to Jacob, alone by the riverbanks and afraid of the impending reunion, a stranger appeared who wrestled him through the night. The text focuses on Jacob, and so do we. But that same night, Esau had his own wrestle on the other side of the river. When Jacob had fled 20 years earlier, their father had finally given in to Esau's pleading and offered a consolation blessing. In it, Isaac promised his elder son that while he would be a servant to his brother, he would also someday break Jacob's yoke from off his neck. Now that promised day had finally come, but Esau had to decide how to fulfill his own promise. He had become a prosperous man and sat at the head of a large army. He could easily slay Jacob, as he had wanted to, but he could also accept the peace offering, overcome his anger, and break free in the fullest and greatest sense. As it happened, Esau chose the high road. He ran to meet his brother in a tearful embrace that ended the wrestling clinch they had been in since before birth. Jacob was so delighted that he compared the joy of seeing Esau to the divine visit from the night before. "I have seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God." A personal note about Isaac and Jacob's relationship. After a year of obsession over this whole story, I finally realized just the week before going to press that it's Isaac's favoritism of Esau over Jacob that has resonated so strongly with me all along. My own mild father, the youngest, smallest, and meekest of two sets of twin boys, seemed always frustrated with me, with my boyhood shyness and sensitivity, but not with my brother Michael, who came 3 years later. I've become a strong man, but like my father, I had to develop that strength by winning and losing matches. Mike was just born strong, strong and wild. Dad loved his spunky son, the son who fought back, who even as a toddler threatened to beat your brains to the moon. Mike still says and does what he wants, while I remain censured by the fear of disappointing our parents. And though I've adopted my father's two greatest loves, wrestling and writing, I've never caught his eye with either. But Dad swells with wet-eyed pride over his younger, feistier son, who's out driving Hummers in Iraq while I sit here guzzling soda at the keyboard. Jacob's many grapples have become personally revealing to me. My brother and I still wrestle every time we see each other, and it's that same hugging while clinching that I see in Jacob and Esau. Yet I've become even more touched by the struggle I imagine Jacob had in trying to earn his father's esteem. He couldn't buy it or steal it, despite his efforts, but I hope he ultimately gained it. Decades after their reunion, Jacob and Esau met again to bury their father. I like to imagine that by then, all three men had come to terms with themselves and with each other. God Wrestling by Arthur Waskow. I wrestled again with my brother last week, first time since I was 12, and Grandma stopped us. She won't even let us fight, we yelled, embracing. Wrestling feels a lot like making love. Why did Jacob wrestle with God? Why did the others talk? God surely enjoyed that all-night fling with Jacob, told him he'd won, renamed him and us the God Wrestler, even left him a limp to be sure he'd remember it all. But ever since, we've only talked. We've only talked. Did something peculiar happen that night? Did somebody say next day we shouldn't wrestle? Who? We should wrestle again, our companion, sometime soon. Wrestling feels a lot like making love. But Esau struggled to his feet from his own wrestle and gasped across the river to his brother. It also feels a lot like making war. End of the sidebar. Back to the article. Wrestling God. I also wrestle at church. As I deal with my nagging questions or bite my lip in elders' quorum, I can choose to hold my faith close while I thrash it about with critical inquiry. I can simultaneously pummel and embrace the church. I relate to Hugh Nibley's statement, quote, "There might be things about the church that I find perfectly appalling, but I know the gospel's true," end quote. So I need not attack it, only wrestle it. Maybe even our praying should be more like wrestling. It's so easy to slip into patterns and repetitions without really praying. I can think of a dozen times I've accidentally blessed the food while saying my bedtime prayers. And how many more times has someone at a ward activity blessed the brownies and soda to nourish and strengthen our bodies? My praying is so formulaic that if I ever stray from the basic blueprint at family prayers, my three-year-old takes note and asks me about it afterward. Enos and Alma both wrestled with God in prayer, and some of the best recorded prayers read more like matches than recitals. When Joseph Smith called out from the misery of Liberty Jail, he didn't hold back. O God, where art thou? How long shall thy hand be stayed? Christ's prayer on the cross is the most grappling invocation I know of. He didn't offer his whole prayer out loud, but he didn't need to. When in the height of his suffering, he cried out, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," I think he meant for us to remember the whole 22nd Psalm. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring? But thou art holy. O thou that inhabitest the praise of Israel, our fathers trusted in thee. They trusted, and thou didst deliver them. But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men, and despised of the people. All they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head. But thou art he that took me out of the womb. Thou didst make me hope when I was upon my mother's breast. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierce my hands and my feet. They part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture. But be thou not far from me, O Lord. O my strength, haste thee to help me. I will declare thy name unto my brethren. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise thee. This psalm describes a real struggle with God and self, a few lines of pushing away, followed by a few more pulling back in, pushing and pulling over and over. That's what it feels like to wrestle God. If I avoid that kind of grappling in my own prayers, it's from estrangement rather than reverence. I can struggle that way with my wife or with a sibling. I know them. My love for them is never in doubt, even in the hottest argument. Maybe I should get to know the Lord well enough that I can wrestle when I pray. As Lowell Bunyan wrote, God himself does not seem to object to our questioning, even him in his ways. Abraham persuaded the Lord to save Sodom if he could find 10 righteous souls. Jacob wrestled with his heavenly antagonist until he got his way. And most impressive of all, Job challenged God's justice and compassion and stood by his own integrity through an extended debate. The most important revelations of any time, including the 1978 reversal of racial exclusion regarding the priesthood, came from wrestling with the matter and then questioning the Lord point blank. Wrestling as atonement. A literal interpretation of Jacob's wrestling creates a blueprint for our own path to overcoming personal deficits and becoming at one with God. Of course, this doesn't mean that our own wrestling will necessarily be literal. We may not, and likely need not, wrestle with a stranger through the night to gain our salvation. As Paul writes, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of the world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. And while wrestling is a big part of my life and the vehicle of this study, it's not meant to be the central theme. It's only important to me as a reminder of the atonement it can symbolize. Being sentimental about any sport is dangerous. It too frequently leads to exaggeration. Like baseball writers who obsess about the metaphor of a lost American innocence, some grapplers have overstated the importance of wrestling. The trend became especially true when Title IX legislation required universities to offer the same number of female and male sports. Since wrestling is boring to watch, brings in little revenue, and has traditionally been gender exclusive, programs all over the country were dropped. Enthusiasts responded with rhetoric, crediting wrestling for everything from the American Revolution and emancipation of the slaves to the heroism of Flight 93. Wrestling is great. It can have rich symbolism, and I believe it's powerful enough to catalyze a personal rebirth. It has been an important positive force in my life, and I derive from it personal meaning that extends far beyond the actual activity. It is potently used in mythology, scripture, spiritual reflection, and diplomacy. But it isn't essential to salvation. We shouldn't skip Ward Temple Night to hit the mats. We need not leave the church to join the Christian Wrestling Federation, where characters named Apocalypse, Angel, Martyr, and the Beast bash each other with garbage cans and folding chairs. Wrestling is like any other human activity. We can endow it with meaning and use it to reflect the divine. Others have touched God by harvesting yams or fixing boats. I've done it by approaching the veil, being with my wife, reading to my kids, climbing mountains, and, on a few occasions, by bearing down on an opponent and choking him until his face turns purple. The end.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Matters of Perspective. We look forward to you joining the conversation about this episode at mormonmatters.org. If you would like to suggest an article for consideration as part of the Matters of Perspective series, please learn more by clicking on the Matters of Perspective menu tab. If any of the Mormon Matters array of podcasts or its blog are an important part of your week, we would love your support to help keep them going and growing. Please click on the Donate or Subscribe tabs at the Mormon Matters website. All gifts are fully tax deductible. The music for Matters of Perspective is graciously provided by the Saber Rattlers, an Austin-based gospel collective led by Mark Abernathy. This recording of Israel, Israel, God is Calling is from their album, Twixt Me and the Peaceful Rest, which is available on CD or via download at www.saberrattlers.com or through iTunes. We also give great thanks to StudioCase.com for providing the Mormon Matters logo.
Now a glorious morn is breaking for the people of His choice. Come to Zion, come to Zion, and within walls rejoice. Come to Zion, come to Zion, and within all walls rejoice. Lord.